Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
Welcome, everyone, to This Week in Global Development. I'm Anna Gavel, Managing Editor of DevEx, filling in for Raj Kumar this week. And I'm delighted to welcome our two guests today. We have my colleague, Senior Reporter Michael Igo. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Anna. How are you?
Good, good. And we also have Yolanda Wright, who is the Vice President of Partnerships for GiveDirectly. Hi, Yolanda. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, lovely to be here. Thanks.
Terrific. So let's start. Last week, DevEx was the media partner for an event called the Global Inclusive Growth Summit, which is hosted by MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. The overarching theme was financial inclusion for the world, but specifically the developing world. It dovetailed with the World Bank IMF spring meetings, because as some of you may know, the bank's president, Ajay Banga, was the longtime CEO of MasterCard, where he stressed the importance of inclusive, sustainable growth. Likewise, the summit stressed the importance of accessing banking services, getting loans to start businesses, etc., as a path for low to middle income countries to achieve sustainable economic growth. But there were moments during the summit, and I'm sure there were also these moments during the spring meetings, of this kind of palpable frustration, I would say. We had the UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed and Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley, who lamented the lack of debt relief, the lack of political will to provide it. There are some startling statistics we've highlighted that 60% of low-income countries are either in debt, distress, or high risk of it. So, Michael, I wanted to start with you. You were here in D.C. last week meeting with various people. What was your kind of general sense on the mood in terms of the topic of debt relief? And what are some of your general thoughts also in terms of the trade-offs of having some of these unsustainable debt loads in the developing world?
Yeah, thanks, Anna. Alarming, for lack of a better word. The level of sort of anxiety that I sensed last week around the spring meetings, everyone just seemed to sort of be aware or willing to acknowledge the situation of kind of institutions and country partners that are just kind of stuck right now in this post-COVID or late COVID phase where a sort of combination of different economic pressures are all bearing down at the same time. And, you know, all of these countries and national leaders and individual institutional leaders all sort of seem to be waiting for the whole system to shift. But I feel like we're sort of stuck in this middle zone where a lot of those processes, like, you know, the Bridgetown initiative that was discussed specifically at the Global Gig Summit that you mentioned, or the process to reform sort of the inner workings of the World Bank. All of these are sort of underway, but going through this kind of muddling process of trying to sort of rework the wiring of these institutions and the global financial system. And, you know, it's a long and difficult process. And in the meantime, as you said, country leaders are faced with really difficult trade-offs and choices between, you know, repaying debt or servicing debt and investing in healthcare, education. So, you know, the just sort of the overarching sense that I got was the frustration that you described and just sort of this feeling of needing to move through the current moment where there's so much kind of inertia to sort of to push out of the way before countries are going to find themselves in a more favorable environment for investing in their own populations.
Yeah, exactly. That's very similar to what I heard is this progress is very incremental. And in terms of debt restructuring, that's obviously a huge undertaking. But the crises that countries are facing are urgent and need to be addressed right now at the moment. So Yolanda, your organization, for those who aren't familiar, does exactly what it names, its name says. It gives money directly to households to help lift them out of poverty. It works in many of the countries that are facing debt distress. What do you think of the situation? What can cash transfers do to possibly play a role? And what are some of the real world impacts that you've been seeing?
Thank you. Yes. I mean, I think, we've been following along on all the happenings in Washington, and I can echo the frustrations that Michael's talking about. I think for many of the countries where we work, these are daily struggles, right? For the governments that we're partnering with, they are facing mounting debts. And as you know, there's quite a lot of inequality in like the rates of lending. The interest rates that very poor countries pay are often significantly higher than the interest rates that higher income countries pay. So the spiraling sort of debt burden that these countries face mean that they really are struggling to make the long-term investments that they know are needed. And cash transfers are one of those kinds of investments. Many countries do provide things like cash in the form of social protection, for example, to their poorest citizens, but they're struggling to expand those programs, to develop those programs to be more effective. Like we see now, many, many climate shocks are already happening. I mean, we're really already in the climate crisis era. And governments know that social protection, getting cash directly to households, would be a helpful way to help them build resilience or respond after a shock, but they just don't have the fiscal space to sort of set up those systems themselves or expand those systems. And organizations like GiveDirectly, have a big role to play. And we're very lucky that we have a generous range of donors, from private sector individuals through to some institutional donors, who help us to provide those kind of transfers. And some of the roles we can play is to try and make those systems that provide the cash the most effective and efficient possible. Use technology, use AI, use whatever means and innovations that are available to kind of reduce the overheads, target more effectively and efficiently, get the money to people who need it most. Because as we're hearing, like the financial resources are scarcer than ever at the moment in terms of ODA, in terms of national government budget space, etc. So it puts even more emphasis on kind of doing things that work as well as possible.
Staying on the subject of cash transfers, there obviously needs to be some more innovative solutions to the cash crunch, the debt crunch and so forth that countries are facing. But, how do you scale? How are you working to scale the cash transfers? Because there are obviously some obstacles to that. And there's questions in terms of the long-term impact of cash transfers. Critics say it's, more of an immediate fix. So how can cash transfers be scaled and to address some of these structural fundamental issues such as education and healthcare, et cetera?
And that's one of the most amazing things about cash transfers is they are a very scalable solution. And especially nowadays, there's been some big, revolutions in things like mobile money in many of the countries we work. I mean, not just Kenya, which is kind of the poster child of mobile money, but really all of the countries we work in now have expanding mobile money systems, which mean that as long as you've got a mobile phone or even just a SIM card, for very poor families, they can swap their SIM cards into one phone. But even with just a SIM card, you can then get access to basically mobile money, a bank account, etc., which is part of this, financial inclusion story that you were talking about at your event last week. So I think, the scalability of cash transfers is enormous. The potential scalability is enormous. Obviously, there are still many people living outside of mobile phone, cell phone coverage range. There's a lot of people who aren't banked, and GiveDirectly have worked, for example, with the private sector, with mobile telcos, to do things like co-finance, mobile cell phone towers in places like Liberia, so that we can help to reach people outside of the kind of current reach of cell towers. We also are doing a lot to sort of try and support financial inclusion of people who don't have ability to be banked. So for example, there's an increasing number, sadly, of people displaced nowadays. Refugees often have trouble accessing things like bank accounts, but in Kenya, we're working with Equity Bank to look at how to provide, refugees with access to bank accounts as well. So with a bit of effort in looking at how do you include those who are normally most excluded from financial systems, we can actually do a huge amount to scale technically. The big barrier, of course, is having the finances available to scale with financial sustainability, especially for governments. And then I just want to quickly, very quickly address the question that you asked about long-term sustainability too, because there's many ways, but I'll try and be quick. But actually, cash is one of the development interventions with the best long-term evidence. We've done cash transfer studies that are 10 and even 12 years. There's one from Uganda that was 12 years after the transfer. And we still, 12 years later, found a 20% increase in people's income. And that was even after the shock of COVID. So we've actually got quite good evidence that even with the sort of shocks of the COVID economic shock, or climate shocks, cash transfers can actually have a long-term sustained impact. But I don't want to talk too long about that, but happy to answer a bit more if it's of interest.
So I think one of the interesting kind of contextual pieces here, or important contextual pieces, is, you know, we're in this world now of highly constrained official development assistance, right? Like there's downward pressure on development budgets in a lot of quarters. Of course, we're seeing record numbers overall, but that's largely because of a few specific recipients like Ukraine and some countries actually shifting assistance to pay for domestic concerns like hosting refugees at home. So the numbers are a bit odd. They look big, but in a number of places they're actually quite constrained. One of the things that jumped out to me last week in Washington, and I noticed this particularly at a health financing forum that I attended that was co-hosted by the World Bank and USAID and Global Financial Facility, is that, you know, government leaders are noticing that. They're noticing that international development assistance has become this sort of scarce resource. And their responses in a number of cases are not just to demand more or to hope for more from donors, but also to be asking themselves and be asking their international partners to think more seriously about how to maximize the efficiency of those resources. I was hearing a lot about donor alignment, like, you know, what are a country's national priorities, or what are a particular presidential administration's national priorities, and how can donors get better aligned around those? I think what Yolanda's saying about, you know, really making the best possible use of this limited pool of funding that's out there, direct cash transfers might be one way to do that. Increased alignment between donors and national governments might be another. I think there's a sort of a re-energizing of this conversation around aid effectiveness right now that's been particularly brought on by the acknowledgement that aid numbers are not just going up all the time. And so I think there is sort of a confluence between the conversation about, you know, the role for direct cash assistance and the role for sort of, you know, what we might consider more traditional forms of development assistance and implementation. I saw those two things coming together in an interesting way.
Yeah, I thought your article was really fascinating. So for those who don't know, it talked about the plight of low and middle income countries whose governments are spending less on healthcare than they did before the pandemic. And a lot of this is because of they have to service their debt. And to your point, I thought it was really fascinating. You had someone from PEPFAR saying there's no hidden pot of money out there, that you have to be smarter since we're spending money the same way we did 10 years ago. Yolanda, do you think, does that resonate with you that we're spending money the same way we were 10 years ago? I mean, cash transfers, like you said, the studies have been done for years and years now, but it still feels like an innovative aid model in a lot of ways. Do you feel like these large institutions such as USAID are embracing the innovation, so to speak, more, or is it still kind of viewed as something, like you mentioned in our op-ed once last year, something to beat rather than to scale?
I think it's really interesting that this aid effectiveness conversation is growing. I think it's super important because, like, money, literally money is genuinely scarce and the challenges are only growing, right? We're seeing that, you know, countries are still suffering from the COVID shocks. Prices are still rising in many contexts, or, you know, inflation is still relatively high in many contexts. So I do think it's super important to look at this effectiveness debate. And I'm not saying cash is the answer to everything by any means. And absolutely, we actually see a lot that cash really does require functioning markets, functioning, or doesn't require it, but like, it's important for cash to really work, to, for there to be functioning markets and for people to be able to pay for good services, right? You know, if you're sick and you have a bit of cash to go to the hospital, you desperately need the hospital to be functioning and to get the care you need. So yeah, I'm not kind of arguing just for cash, but I do think this debate over effective use of scarce development assistance finance is a really important debate. And on the issue of things like cash, which does have a really good evidence base, I think it is changing, but I see that it, you know, cash has really gained ground in the humanitarian space, but in the development space, I still feel like it hasn't, you know, it's not at the potential that it should be at. I think it's not the answer to everything. It's not a silver bullet, but I definitely feel that there's a lot of inertia about changing the types of projects we do that we already have, unfortunately, some evidence that don't work, right? And we're still doing, I'm still seeing projects being designed in very old fashioned ways as they have been over 10, 20 years of my career in development. So I do think it's an important question to be asking, and it's important to be pushing ourselves more and more to be being as effective as we possibly can with our dollars. And I do agree that with cash, I mean, actually USAID has been a great supporter of GiveDirectly in terms of funding some of our benchmarking studies, and it is funding us to do some cash, but I don't think it's at the scale it should be yet. And I think those questions need to be asked in every sector, like what is the most efficient and effective way of doing whatever we're attempting to do.
Hi, I'm Kate Warren, Executive Editor at DevEx. If you are listening to this podcast, you're likely working to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. But are you subscribed to DevEx Newswire? Global development can be a fast-moving, complex sector. Our team of global reporters work every day to bring you the news you need to make sense of it all. In DevEx Newswire, we keep you up to date on issues ranging from climate change financing to gender equality and global health to transforming the food system, all in a fun-to-read, free newsletter delivered directly to you 5 days a week. Join the hundreds of thousands of global development professionals who receive DevEx Newswire and visit devx.com/newsletters to sign up to this free newsletter today.
We had a story out today. This is speaking of innovation. It's a new AI tool that was launched this week. It's called Grant Assist, which uses a custom language learning model to make grant proposals easier to navigate, hopefully easier to win. It was launched by two former USAID chiefs, William Steiger and Sean Carroll. Now, Michael, you've written a lot about the complexities of applying for USAID grants. Do you think AI and this tool might help move the needle for some of the smaller organizations that struggle with applying for these grants?
Yeah, this is such a fascinating story and a really interesting initiative. So it's two former USAID chiefs of staff, one Republican, one Democrat, sort of banded together to essentially kind of figure out if AI can be used to simplify the grant process. And the reason that's important is that, you know, this is sort of one of the barriers to USAID and presumably other donors working with new partners, and particularly local partners. It's just the sort of massive barrier to entry that comes with trying to apply for a typical USAID grant or contract. So, you know, the idea being, if you could take an AI application and you know, run part of your grant proposal process through that, that might sort of cut down on the costs and you know, the human capital costs that you would otherwise need to invest in sort of figuring out how to be a USAID implementing partner. And that, you know, speaks directly to the big push around localization right now, which, you know, has been embraced by Administrator Samantha Power and you know, administrators before her as well, but which we've really seen kind of halting progress towards. Administrator Power's target is 25% of USAID's funding should go to local organizations. Right now they're around 10%. She acknowledged sometime in the last few weeks, I think for the first time publicly, that the agency is not going to hit that 25% goal. So you know, it's interesting now to see sort of some, not just the kind of political and policy signaling around localization, but some actual like technological innovation around localization. This is one of the first, or at least an early example of that, that I can sort of think of. And it makes me wonder if that's an area where we're going to see more investment and experimentation around the actual sort of technical capabilities that are required to make this process work better for local and other underutilized organizations.
Yeah, I think we're definitely only on the cusp of what AI could potentially do, not just for grant writing, but just in development sectors in general. You've seen it pinpoint like pests, for instance, to help the agricultural sector. So, you know, we're just at the beginning of this big experiment. Yolanda, I'm curious, because you touched on AI before. How has AI impacted Give Directly? Is your organization kind of experimenting with it as well? And how are you finding, what are some of your thoughts on what it can do for development in general?
And I think it's got huge potential. And I agree, this grant assist AI should, you know, could have, it's too early to tell, but, you know, I think it's very helpful to help especially smaller organizations navigate these hundreds of pages of requirements from USAID. So I think it's a very welcome starting point, but I think there's a huge, enormous range of ways in which AI could be supporting effective development into the future. And yes, Give Directly is doing some work on it. We've had some help from organizations like Google.org. We've used AI to improve targeting of our cash assistance. So we did that actually in the COVID era, which was really helpful, using kind of completely remote targeting when we couldn't do in-person, you know, because of COVID restrictions, we couldn't even do any sort of in-person identification of recipients and follow-up, etc. So, you know, AI was really helpful in combining things like satellite imagery that both identified like lower income households from this, you know, from satellite images of the urban areas. We also overlaid existing other data, government data, etc., mobile phone metadata, etc., to target low income households, that showed actually that it could be quite an accurate way of doing it. Competing quite well with very slow, time-consuming in-person surveys. We've also used it linked to the climate crisis, which is so relevant. Again, I've been just listening to my colleagues in Nairobi suffering from incredible floods right now at the moment. And we've used AI to look at predictive models, like where might be affected by floods or extreme events, and where could we do anticipatory cash? Because we've seen that giving people even a smaller amount of cash in advance can actually be more cost effective, linked to the cost effective argument, but also post disaster. You know, satellite images can be really helpful in identifying houses that have been destroyed by cyclones, etc. And again, you know, much more quick and effective ways of targeting. You may still need in-person follow-up afterwards. Nothing's ever perfect. And we've been quite careful to always do a little bit of in-person stuff as well to look at the accuracy and try to avoid exclusion errors, et cetera, that you might get from AI models. Because, you know, you've always got to be a bit careful about what the AI throws out and make sure that you're kind of also doing some ground truthing. But I think there's a huge amount of potential. And as I look at the increasing risk of like extreme events, for example, I do think that's something that could be really scalable, and governments and age agencies could be really looking into the use of AI in targeting people most in need.
Pretty good for summarizing 100 plus page USAID Inspector General reports too.
I'm glad it's useful. No, it's definitely with reports and doing these executive summaries. I think it's been invaluable. And like I said, we are just on the cusp of what it could potentially do. You know, Yolanda, I think it was interesting that you mentioned climate, because a lot of what Give Directly is doing deals with loss and damage now. This is obviously a huge issue in the climate space, very contentious one in terms of, you know, what some would call climate reparations. But Give Directly is, like you said, more anticipatory. And how can you talk us a bit more on what it can do on the loss and damage front? I believe there's a meeting coming up next week. What is it doing in terms of addressing kind of locally on a local scale this loss and damage issue, if you will.
Yeah, so this loss and damage issue has been contentious, and many of the sort of lowest income countries have been really outspoken about the need to create a loss and damage fund, which was created at last year's COP. And the first meeting, I think, of the new board of this loss and damage fund is next week. And so what GiveDirectly has tried to do is pilot what could potentially be an example, a way of using that fund. And loss and damage is about, you know, when climate extremes have happened and you can no longer adapt, you've experienced an extreme event and you've experienced loss and damage, which can be economic, but can also be a range of other things. And many small island developing states, for example, talk about loss of cultural heritage, loss of graveyards to the sea, etc. So I must, you know, emphasize that while cash is really important potential part of loss and damage, it's not only about economic losses. So what we did is we've been partnered with the government of Scotland, actually, who've been a real kind of forerunner on this loss and damage issue. And the government of Scotland gave us some money to give to people in Malawi who were affected by an extreme cyclone last year and completely lost their homes, their livelihoods, and had to be relocated to safer areas. So we've piloted just giving a lump sum of cash to those households that were affected. And we're seeing incredible impacts from that. People are able to use, the great thing about unconditional cash is people can use it in whatever way they want to, you know, to rebuild homes, to kind of strengthen their homes, to make them more resilient, to like rebuild livelihoods, to diversify their livelihoods, to look at other options. You know, perhaps agriculture, rain-fed agriculture is becoming so vulnerable, they might want to, you know, branch out into other businesses, etc. So we're seeing a whole range of uses of that cash. And one of the things I love about cash is that sort of empowering, localized impact, right? Because people have the power and the choice and the dignity to make their own decisions about it. So we've done that work. We're coming to the end of that work and we'll be doing the reporting very soon. But we think that's a really exciting and innovative example of how this loss and damage fund could potentially be used, because we've seen so much climate finance getting stuck up at higher levels or being given to middle income countries. And this loss and damage fund really needs to be able to reach the most vulnerable, the people who've been the most directly affected and often who have the least capacity to cope with those extreme events.
Exactly. There's an element of immediacy, whereas waiting for a fund to actually be stood up is, as we know with the $100 billion climate finance promise, annual promise, we saw how long that took to stand up. And even then, there's questions on the projects that it's financing. So I think that's really interesting. Now, I know we're coming up on time. One last story that I wanted to highlight that we've done, which is timely, is the passage here. It's been in the headlines everywhere of the U.S. supplemental bill for Ukraine, $95 billion supplemental bill for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. It's been widely covered, but I think what hasn't been as widely covered is that there's $9.2 billion that's tucked into that bill for humanitarian assistance. $5.6 billion will go to USAID, with the rest going to the State Department. And I think there are two important points here that are interesting. Is one, this money is not earmarked, so it could go, I don't want to say effectively anywhere, but it could go to a number of neglected crises. So talking like Sudan and Rohingya refugees. Second, you know, this is something that a lot of people in our article pointed out, is just how much USAID has come to depend on these kind of emergency supplemental bills. And to its supporters, it indicates how inadequate the base funding is. So I'd just be curious, either Michael, Yolanda, to get your take on this financial boost that U.S. humanitarian efforts have just received. And do you think that, you know, it's a good thing, but in the grander scheme of things, it's kind of a Band-Aid?
I think that's pretty well summarized, Anna. I mean, obviously $9+ billion for humanitarian assistance at a time of unprecedented need is not something to be, you know, written off or taken lightly. It's pretty critical cash infusion for an agency that is doing more around the world than it has ever done before. So I think that's, you know, the first thing to say. The reason, you know, you mentioned that this $9 billion can go to a range of different places, even though it's a Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan bill, it can assist in neglected in helping to address neglected crises. I mean, one of the reasons those crises are neglected is because of these massive, you know, conflicts that are really pulling so much in the way of resources in. So, you know, this is sort of USAID and others have been forced to scramble to address the needs in Ukraine in particular and increasingly Gaza. And as a result, you know, that's pulling resources from the rest of the agency. So they're in this position where they need a supplemental to sort of fund the things that they might otherwise be doing, lest those kind of completely fall off the map. So it does create, I think, this sort of almost, you know, architectural problem for USAID funding, which is that the budget, you know, numerically, it's almost like the problem we were talking about before, like the budget numerically is increasing, the need is increasing faster, and the agency is in this situation where it requires these sort of one-off emergency cash infusions to be able to carry out its programming. So that raises the question, you know, what happens if those stop? We saw a big fight, a big political fight over whether this would happen at all. And if it doesn't, you know, you saw Samantha Power sort of talk about the what that would mean in terms of the agency's humanitarian programs kind of falling off a cliff. So, you know, you could imagine a future where USAID's budget sort of retracts back to a non-emergency state, but it has to figure out how to get resources to these places that have been relying on emergency funding. And I think that's, you know, that's really concerning to a lot of people. And you know, one potential negative outcome would be that funding gets redirected from things like long-term development assistance to, you know, sort of the firefighting of humanitarian work. So I think, you know, there are a lot of long-term questions here. Obviously, the development community would say that in the short term, it's absolutely vital that these funds are available.
Yeah, no, I think you hit on an excellent point that this is this kind of cycle of where we're giving to humanitarian crises, but depriving long-term development of money. And Yolanda, you mentioned this. This is an issue with cash transfers as well, that it tends to be viewed as something in to be given out in emergency situations, but it hasn't been incorporated into kind of the development, the long-term architecture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just quickly saying, adding to Michael's point on the US, I mean, with, you know, it's great that this has come through, but I agree it's a worrying situation that we rely on these kind of emergency bills. But it also, I think it's worth emphasizing that, you know, the world is relying a lot on the US's generosity, right? And I've seen in many other countries declining ODA budgets or declining spend in places that are the poorest because of what Michael was saying, you know, many very big conflicts that are causing, you know, donors to redirect funding. You know, Ukraine has been one of those for a long time. And Europe was also often diverting its ODA to fund refugees in their first year in country and things. So there's reasons why ODA is declining. But I think it makes it, you know, US has become sometimes a really high percentage of the development assistance in certain crises and certain contexts. I know certainly in Somalia. So I think that, you know, we're kind of circling back to where we began, which is the sort of the scarcity of development assistance is worrying, I think, very broadly. And certainly, you know, with cash assistance, one of the things we're trying to do is give, you know, very poor people an injection of cash to sustain their own livelihoods, to help them to kind of get out of that very, that trap of poverty where you're kind of stuck in daily wage labor, you're not able to invest, you know, if you can't work, if you get sick, you can't, you know, support your families, etc. But I think, you know, generally the loss of long-term development assistance is a worry, and that's the sort of thing that needs to help to support countries to create a sustainable financial future for themselves. They need to get out of this debt cycle and into a sort of, you know, situation where they're able to generate tax revenue and spend their own money on their services. So I think it's a micro, you know, at the micro level, we need more development assistance to directly reach the extreme poor, which is what, you know, Give Directly specializes in. But at the macro level, we need to also be looking at, you know, urgently, how do we, yeah, bring a bit more urgency to this issue of ensuring that we're actually providing sustained support to countries to lift themselves out of poverty.
Yeah, I think we've on that note, come full circle, like we said, kind of the importance of sustainable growth and assistance. Well, we are up on time, but I want to say a deep thank you to Yolanda and Michael for joining us today.
Thank you both. This was great.
Thank you very much.
And thank you everyone for joining us, and we will see you next week.
This has been This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe using the link in the description. To get even more coverage and analysis on the most pressing development issues of the day, become a DevEx Pro member by going to devx.com/membership and signing up. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.